From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, an eyewitness to today's quake in Kathmandu. Is Russia taking on a renewed interest in the Middle East?
One interest, of course, is simply to thwart the United States and the West in general.
Horrific abuse reportedly is driving migrants across the Mediterranean. And the WHO accelerates research and development for disease. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Another strong earthquake measuring 7.3 has struck eastern Nepal, shaking the country less than 3 weeks after it was devastated by an even more powerful quake. At least 41 people were killed today. Nepal's home ministry says more than 1,100 people were injured. Anjana Pasricha reports from Mumbai. The tremors were felt across neighboring India and Bangladesh.
For millions of traumatized people in Nepal, Tuesday's quake was a frightening replay of the April 25th disaster that killed thousands and claimed homes and loved ones. As the ground shook once again, people fled their homes into the streets. Shops that had reopened just days ago hastily closed. Traffic jams snarled Kathmandu streets. Telephone circuits were inundated with desperate calls from loved ones, making sure their families were safe. The quake struck shortly after noon local time and was followed by powerful shocks. The streets remained packed for hours as people wondered what lay in store for them next. One aid worker, Moolchand Dedia, described the scene in the country to reporters.
I think there's still a lot of confusion. People still are actually in a dilemma of what to do next. I think they're still going to be waiting here for quite some time to figure out the next step. But I think I'm pretty sure that people here are pretty shaken with the entire episode at this point of time. So I don't think they will be venturing anywhere for at least for some more time.
In Chothara town in Nepal, which suffered heavily in last month's quake, there were reports of several casualties and of injured people streaming into hospital tents. Building collapses were also reported from several places. Television footage showed Nepal's parliament shake as the quake struck. The airport was shut down temporarily. Power went off in the capital, Kathmandu. The epicenter of the latest earthquake lay in an isolated area close to Mount Everest and Nepal's border with Tibet. In Zangmu, a town in Tibet close to the border, people also ran out into open areas. A Chinese seismologist told state broadcaster CCTV the impact of Tuesday's quake could be worse for this area as the epicenter lay closer to Nepal's border with China. L.S. Rathore, head of India's meteorological department, said this quake was deeper than the one that struck in April. Deeper quakes generally cause less destruction, but Rathore said Tuesday's jolt had the potential to cause damage. He says structures which have already been weakened by the previous earthquake could become even more vulnerable after the latest quake struck. Concerns are being expressed that the relief and recovery work, which is in full swing in Nepal, could suffer a setback. Just days ago, Nepalese authorities had asked all international rescue teams to leave the country as the focus turned to relief measures. The tremors of the latest quake were felt across India and Bangladesh. In the capital, New Delhi, thousands of workers ran out of high-rise buildings. Last month's earthquake killed more than 8,000 people, injured more than 17,000, and has left one of the world's poorest countries struggling with a massive reconstruction task. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
VOA correspondent Steve Herman was in and around Kathmandu after the first quake struck Nepal and spoke with us today from our Asia Bureau in Bangkok about the most recent quake.
Many buildings in Kathmandu and elsewhere that withstood the initial magnitude 7.8 quake were severely damaged. And this latest big quake occurred near the Chinese border, actually quite close to Mount Everest, and very close to the worst hit area from the first quake where there was the most damage and casualties that we visited.
When you were there, they were already having trouble getting supplies in. What is the situation now?
Well, you got to imagine that perhaps this sets everything back almost to day one. The difference is that you do have international agencies and NGOs, both Nepali and foreign, that are on the ground working there. So there are some supplies in the country, although from what we saw when we were there, they were woefully inadequate. This latest big tremor did again cause a temporary halt to flights at Kathmandu's only Nepal's only international airport. Air traffic has now resumed, so presumably, unless there's some significant damage on the runway, they'll be able to continue getting relief supplies in. But obviously, they are still in an assessment mode at this point with fresh avalanches, structures that are down.
Last time there was a significant avalanche on Mount Everest. Any word on the conditions there?
No, we haven't had any reports from the base camp. I'm not even sure if there's anybody really there right now. The climbing season has been called off because the skilled people that were needed to make the pass have gone home to help their own families and participate in the original rescue and aid efforts. So it's more the communities that would be around the area of Mount Everest, although we do not expect that there were as many people, especially as many tourists and foreigners in that area due to the climbing season having been called off.
Well, thank you very much for your insight, Steve.
My pleasure, Susan.
Sudarshan Shashta is with Save the Children in Kathmandu. Can you please share with us your experience today with the earthquake?
Yeah, I was actually at one of the biggest hospitals in the country, the Patan Hospital, and I was actually interviewing one of the doctors along with a rated journalist from the Deutsche Welle about the doctors or the hospital's experience during the first earthquake when it struck on the 25th of April. Like, how was the hospital able to cope with the influx of emergency cases? And what was it like, how prepared the hospital was, and what Save the Children had done prior to the earthquake striking, things like pre-positioning medicines. So we were actually talking with the doctor and interviewing him and when it actually struck. So we thought it was just maybe a jolt, just like something we've been experiencing in the past 2 weeks. And we waited and it just continued to shake, and then that's when we had to run out of the hospital building. And what we saw was like chaos and pandemonium with all patients inside the building running out and maybe 300 to 350 people, patients inside the building running out. And when we were there, as it happened, we were there about more than about 15 minutes after the earthquake struck. And what we saw was at least about 5 to 6 ambulances running into the emergency section of the hospital.
What about damage to the buildings in the neighborhoods?
Nothing happened to the hospital, at least until the time that we were there. We didn't see any damage to the building, except that all the people inside the hospital compound had come out of the 450-bed hospital. From there on, I drove back home, which is pretty close to where the hospital is, and in the vicinity, we did see some buildings that had collapsed. I heard over the news some very tall buildings, 4-5-story buildings inside the Kathmandu Valley had kind of come down.
Save the Children has been on the scene since the first quake. What have you been doing for the people there?
Interventions initially in the first 2 days was a little centered around the Kathmandu Valley because of accessibility and the little pre-positioned stocks that we had. So that was our first intervention. But as the stocks did come in and as we got more information of the extent of the damage and where it was needed, we started going out. We were given one of the most affected districts in the Palchok, which is east of the Kathmandu. We were given by the government to be the lead. So of the 14 districts that were affected, I think we were working in 7 of the districts. And it was actually a stretch for us. As late as yesterday is that we were in one of the remote districts in the Himalayan range called Rasuwa in the Langtan region. We had actually airlifted our crew because there was no access to road. There was a village of more than about 200 people, but nothing had reached there. So we actually airlifted a team, and they had just landed at about noon yesterday. So, yeah, we've been trying to reach as far a place as possible.
And what now? Now after the second quake?
Yeah, very difficult to say, but I can only say that we are just going to be stretched because we were already stretched. There were villages in Sindhupalchuk and other areas which had not been reached as late as yesterday. As news came into our office that no relief had reached those areas. So now with this quake, the most recent quake is, we don't know the extent of damage, but looking at the news and what the scale of the quake was, which is pretty close to what we experienced on the 25th. So it's really hard to say at this moment the extent of damage, but I can say for sure is that it's going to be difficult to get back on our feet, just in terms of responding to relief needs. As the monsoon is away in just about 4 weeks or 5 weeks' time, so we really have to think hard about how we respond to the needs of the people.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. I'm sorry for your experience.
Thank you very much.
Sudarshan Shrestha with Save the Children in Kathmandu, Nepal. Russia has announced the lifting of its ban on the sale to Iran of S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. Some feel this indicates Russia may take on a strategic role in the Middle East as the U.S. disengages. Russian influence in the Middle East reduced after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the decline of American military action in the region, and the Arab Spring toppling of leaders such as Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. But now Russia is promoting warmer relations with rulers like Egypt's president Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. After a portion of U.S. military aid to Egypt was suspended, Russia promised to fill the void with no strings attached. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University, about Russian interest in the Middle East.
I think at present the Russians are hoping to keep their influence in Syria through supporting Assad. And I think that they also are trying very hard to keep what influence they have in Iran that they fear they might lose if a nuclear accord between the P5 plus one and Iran is achieved.
In your latest policy paper, you identified several Russian interests in the Middle East. What are these interests and how does Russia advance them?
Well, one interest, of course, is simply to thwart the United States and the West in general. A second interest is to prevent the rise of Sunni radicalism in particular. A third is to increase Russian exports to the region. And a fourth is to work against those forces that serve to lower the price of oil and gas on the world market because Russia is so heavily dependent on high prices to support the Russian government budget.
Russia seems more successful in pursuing its interests in Europe and in Ukraine in particular. Why do you think Russia is less successful in the Middle East?
I think Russia is less successful in the Middle East just because it's a much more difficult environment for Russia to operate in. I think that the problem that Russia, you know, faces in the Middle East is that there are many actors who are pursuing their interests, and even Russia's friends are doing things that are not necessarily in Russia's interests, it seems to me. The Iranians in particular, obviously one of the things that they seem to be wanting right now is an improved relationship with the United States. This is something I think that many Russian observers are nervous about. They feel that if an improvement in Iranian-American relations will lead to decreased Russian influence in Iran, but they feel relatively powerless because if they tried to prevent a rapprochement between Iran and the United States, I think that Iran would just go ahead anyway because they, they're not going to listen to what the Russians have to say about the matter.
What was the impact of the Arab Spring on the Russian interests in the Middle East?
The Arab Spring, I think, made Russia very, very nervous that, they saw this as a further example of so-called color revolutions, which they refused to acknowledge have any local causes, but they see as something orchestrated by America and the West with the intention of damaging Russian influence. And I think that they're very fearful that the Arab Spring has unleashed forces that will ultimately harm Russian interests. And so they've been very nervous ever since it happened.
Final question. How do you explain the lack of Russian interest in promoting democracy in the Middle East and instead trying to have warm relations with authoritarian figures like in Egypt and Syria?
There's two things, it seems to me. It's that there are those in Moscow who really feel that the promotion of democracy in the Middle East is bad for Russia because this would lead to pro-Western governments. And then there are those in Moscow who feel that democracy simply isn't possible in the Middle East and that to promote democracy would merely lead to the downfall of stable authoritarian regimes and the rise of truly hostile forces that are not just anti-Russian but also anti-Western, and that it's really not in the West's interest to do this, but that the West doesn't seem to realize it. So I think that they feel that it's not possible whatever happens to the West, Russia will definitely suffer through this process.
Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University. This week, Europe will debate setting up a quota system for allocating among EU member states the hundreds of thousands of refugees arriving on the continent. The discussion comes as Amnesty International warns that brutal treatment of migrants in Libya, including beating, torture, and rape, is driving many to escape across the Mediterranean. Henry Ridgewell has details from London.
As Europe's politicians continue to debate immigration, the boats keep on coming. At Reggio Calabria in southern Italy, more than 400 migrants were brought ashore by German naval vessels. Germany is also bearing the greatest burden of refugees. Over 400,000 asylum seekers are expected to arrive in the country this year, double last year's total. It prompted German Chancellor Angela Merkel to hold an emergency summit Friday, in which she called for European partners to share responsibility. She said there will be no alternative to European solidarity to get a solution. Hundreds of refugees pass through Italy's Milan station en route to Germany every week. Volunteer aid worker Susie Iovieno offers them food, clothing and advice. She says Europe must make reforms. She said this is needed to create a humanitarian corridor, give the possibility to these people to apply for an entry visa legally at the different embassies in the neighbouring countries like Lebanon, Jordan and Turkey. That would help avoid the illegal transport and risky trips to Europe, she said. Europe will debate such proposals Wednesday, including a quota system for accepting asylum seekers across member states. Hungary, which is on the route for migrants coming from the Balkans, is one of several nations to have already rejected quotas. Prime Minister Viktor Orban gave this blunt response. We don't want to see immigrants in Hungary, he said. If other EU members ask our opinion, I say to them that I think you should not want to either. Many European states blame the chaos in Libya for the influx of boats and have called for warships along the Libyan coast. But that idea is rejected by the interim prime minister of the government set up by militias controlling Tripoli, one of two rival administrations for the country. Khalifa Al-Gweil said, "What we want from the European Union is to deal directly with the National Salvation Government in Tripoli and cooperate with it and provide it with the capabilities to curb the migration." Human rights group Amnesty International says the migrants are subjected to horrendous conditions in Libya, which is driving many to escape across the Mediterranean. Magdalena Mugrabi Talhami is from Amnesty.
They face labor exploitation when they're forced to work for without any pay. They face indefinite detention for migration purposes. Inside those detention centers, they do face widespread torture and other ill treatment, including beatings with sticks, whips, cables.
Meanwhile, Italian divers have located the sunken boat in which more than 700 people are thought to have drowned last month off Libya. Many bodies are still trapped inside. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Experts at a high-level World Health Organization meeting have agreed on a roadmap for accelerating research and development into two new medical products to fight Ebola and other epidemic-prone diseases. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
More than 11,000 people in West Africa lost their lives to Ebola because there were no medical preparations to combat this deadly disease. Scientists, industry representatives, and public health officials attending this two-day WHO meeting agree the situation cannot be allowed to continue. WHO Assistant Director General Marie-Paul Kini says Ebola is not unique in this regard. She says the world was totally unprepared to deal with epidemics of SARS or severe acute respiratory syndrome and the H1N1 bird flu. To remedy this, she says participants are working on a new framework to speed up research and development for diseases that could become epidemics and other health threats. This way, she says, the next time the world is faced with an epidemic, it can respond more quickly and effectively.
If something like Ebola ever happens again to this level, the world needs to be ready with a blueprint, an R&D preparedness plan with clear rules, platform for information sharing, established processes to expedite development and clinical trials, to activate coordinated action and limit the damage.
Dr. Kini says for certain diseases, the development of medical products should be started before a potential outbreak. She says the speed with which new tools for Ebola were developed and clinical trials for vaccines and drugs were set up shows the world can react more quickly than in the past to combat spreading diseases.
We now have commercial diagnostics to detect Ebola and at least two possibly effective vaccines. I say possibly because for the time being we have no proof that they are efficacious indeed. These results should normally have taken 5 to 10 years if you start the time from where we were in August in 2014. And all this was done in less than 10 months. So what is emerging is an interesting model for R&D that reaches far beyond this particular epidemic and disease. It's not only about Ebola.
But Dr. Kini notes the window of opportunity for testing is closing. As Ebola wanes, she notes there may not be enough cases to continue testing the vaccines and several candidate drugs. On Saturday, the WHO declared Liberia Ebola-free, and latest reports show just 7 confirmed cases of Ebola in Guinea and 2 in Sierra Leone. Kini considers this move toward 0 cases in Ebola-ravaged West Africa extremely good news. She says testing can go on in other ways. For example, she says the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, has a pathway called Animal Rule, which uses 2 animal models for judging the safety and efficacy of Ebola medications in humans. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.